Thank you for standing by. Today's conference call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. If you need assistance during your call, please press star then zero. You may begin.
All right. Good morning, everybody. My name is Joe Pateski. I'm a member of the Cassini flight team here at JPL. And I'd like to welcome today's speaker, Dr. Jeff Moore. Dr. Moore received his undergraduate degrees in geology and history from the University of Oklahoma and his graduate degrees in geology from Arizona State University. After grad school and a postdoctoral position at Ames, Dr. Moore worked as a research scientist at the SETI Institute, which I guess is redundant. Since 1999, he has been a research scientist at NASA Ames, where his research specialties include the geology of Mars and the icy satellites of the outer solar system. And along with using data from a plethora of missions, Dr. Moore is involved with NASA's New Horizons mission and the Mars Exploration Rover Science Team, and he was a longtime member of the Galileo Imaging Team to give a very short, brief look at his many interests and involvements. Dr. Moore.
Good morning or afternoon. Thank you for joining me. Well, probably many of you know that Bob Pappalardo and I have been spouting heresy about Titan. As you know, there's a paper that just came out in Icarus, which covers our initial arguments on why we should be circumspect in embracing right away the idea that Titan might be very endogenically active. And so I'm going to review that material first and then actually last in this presentation. And then I'll also review some of the material that I've been doing with my colleague Alan Howard at the University of Virginia. He's a hydrologist and a person who's a specialist in landform evolution modeling, where we've been, amongst other things, raining on other icy satellites to see if we can get landscapes which resemble those of Titan. First, let's start with this first image. I hope you can read in the corner, in the lower left-hand corner, this is a painting by Don Davis, and the date on that painting is 11/29/1980. He did this painting based upon the single first post-encounter press conference after the Voyager 1 flyby of Titan. So it's interesting to look at this painting and realize how well Don walked away from the good briefing it was given based upon mostly radio data and some spectroscopic data acquired by Voyager 1. Well, a little historical aside, let's also cover some more of the brief history of our studies of Titan. Let's go to slide 2. Well, as you all know, an atmosphere containing methane was discovered by Kuiper in 1944, and by 1980 there were these two extreme models for Titan's atmosphere that were being seriously considered. One was an idea of a pure methane atmosphere in equilibrium with methane ice, and people estimated atmospheric pressure of around 20 millibars, something comparable to that of Mars. And then there was the radically different idea that it might be many bars of N2 of a small amount of CH4, which Don Hutton proposed. So slide 3. Well, in November 1980, Voyager 1 flew by, and as I alluded earlier, radio occultation data and other experiments indicated that Don was right, that it was an atmosphere dominated by nitrogen, surface pressure about 1.5 bars. That's 1.5 times the atmospheric pressure of the Earth at the surface, with clouds and aerosols of CH4 and other alkanes and other hydrocarbons. And the initial speculation, as you got from the painting, suggested a surface subjected to methane rain due to the nearness of the triple point and precipitant fallout of heavy hydrocarbons produced in the atmosphere and covering a surface of otherwise water, ice, bedrock. Let's go to the next slide, slide 4. Then in the early 1980s, Jonathan Lundin and David Stevenson worked on a very interesting bit of analysis in which they proposed that if Titan, the present atmospheric composition of Titan is basically the composition of the atmosphere since time immemorial, since, you know, for several billion years, that at this point Titan should be covered by an ocean down to several kilometers, composed mainly of ethane with some methane mixed in. And as I say, this was based upon an equilibrium chemistry over solar system lifetime. Several proposals were made on how to test that, and the first good test came in the early 1990s when Earth-based radar cast doubt on the global ocean, and by 1994, for instance, Hubble imaging could clearly show that there were these large-scale permanent albedo markings, as you can see in the bottom of slide 4. let's go to slide 5. Okay, well, now this is a point which most all of you on this telecon are intimately familiar with. You guys are the ones who did it, the Cassini-Huygens initial looks at Titan in 2004 and 2005. The scale of the atmosphere is too hazy to clearly identify geologic features from orbit using ISS. The initial radar was difficult to interpret. However, Huygens very clearly saw evidence for fluvial activity, as you can see in the image at the bottom. Let's go to slide 6. And so by the end of the primary mission in 2008, there have been about 44 radar flybys of Titan. The synthetic aperture radar system, as I'm sure you all know, typically can do resolutions nominally between 0.35 to 1.7 kilometers per pixel, and I know they also take images that are lower resolution than that quite frequently. Although, as all of you who have experience of image interpretation know, that although, you know, while radar has certainly been the lifesaver in trying to understand the landform and geologic processes of Titan, it's certainly, you know, not equivalent to, you know, high-quality, high-definition, large signal-to-noise imaging that you might get of an airless body, for instance, like the pictures ISS can take of the middle-sized icy satellites. And so there's things like, you know, noise and the speckliness of the images effectively lower this resolution number that I gave. And as you know, there's been some topographic information available, both some stuff that Randy Kirk has done using radio grammetry, which is basically the same principle as stereo imaging. We simply use the parallax between two different images taken in different viewing geometries to determine what's up and down, as well as some very clever work done by Stiles, where he has also done something similar between the strips. And again, I'm preaching the converted. You guys already know all this stuff. You know, I just want to leave with a statement on this particular subject that topography is absolutely essential in understanding landscapes as unusual as that of Titans, and given the ambiguities that one has with radar imaging. And so it's been quite a tribute to the Cassini team and scientists and engineers to come up with ingenious ways to derive the topography they have. And thank God for that topography. It's what has allowed us to, you know, press forward trying to understand this very complex landscape. Let's go to slide 7. Well, okay, here's the punchline, that, you know, Titan's global geologic evolution is difficult to interpret, not only because we've only seen about 25% of Titan, and it's kind of, there's large gaps between the image swaths, there's also a very limited elevation information in the data we do have. So what is the geologic history of Titan, and what even are the principal geologic processes which operate on that surface are challenging. It's much less easy to do this than it is, for instance, with you know, doing high resolution global mapping maps of Dione, for instance, or Iapetus. Let's go to slide 8. And in fact, a historical example that both Bob and I give in our Icarus paper, and one which I think is instructive to think about, was the experience of trying to understand Mars way back in 1969 based upon Mariner 6 and 7 coverage. Mariner 6 and 7, I think most of you recall, were two flyby missions. Between the two of them, acquired about 20% of, imaging about 20% of the surface of Mars at about 1 to 2 kilometers per pixel, and then much of the rest of the surface at much lower resolution. And again, based upon what people thought they understood about planetary surfaces, mostly informed from our very ongoing exploration of the moon at the time, people were very circumspect in trying to interpret what they could see. And so, for instance, I would show you that one of the images that they acquired in the equatorial regions of Mars actually had one of these very strange sinuous troughs in the scene. And there was a lot of pressure on the Mars community in 1969 to make Mars sound more Earth-like and more amenable to life than the impressions people had gotten of Mars and sort of shocking results that came from Mariner 4 in 1965. And so there was pressure on the team to, you know, to say something about Earth-like processes operating on Mars. But nevertheless, the small camera team on the Mariner 6 and 7 mission of which several of the members are still alive and active scientists in our community, and I've actually spoke to them and asked them what were they even thinking amongst themselves, much less what they reported in their papers, and they said we were just very conservative about discussing this feature on the upper left, which, by the way, is Everest Vallis, which we now strongly believe is produced by fluvial erosion and runoff. And that would have been a tremendous thing for them to have made the claim in 1969, but they didn't because they were concerned that such features of similar size and shape have been seen on the moon, which turned out to be collapsed lava tubes. In fact, to show you some sense of the conservatism of that team, the bright feature called Nix Olympica, which they could see was a bright annulus of a dot in the center, they interpreted as a 500-kilometer diameter impact crater, which, of course, is, in fact, one of the largest volcanoes in the solar system. Let's go to slide 9. Okay, well, I'm going to blast through these pretty quickly. I think we all know that everybody in the community that studies Titan's geology, you know, don't doubt that they're impact craters. Slide 10, we don't doubt that there's spectacular alien transportation and deposition going on, and maybe erosion, but we just don't have the resolution to see that. And slide 11, there's spectacular alkane, fluvial, and lacustrine erosion, transportation, and deposition taking on Titan. So those geologic processes are unambiguous. They're all also exogenic. They're all driven by processes which operate from above. They are due to impact cratering from space, or they're due to the insistent fall of rain and runoff and ponding of fluids on the surface, or else material being blown across the surface by winds. Let's go to slide 12. Now, as I'm sure many of you know, there have been putative cryogenic features identified on Titan, and here are a few of those features, and I want to talk about some of the ones which for a while received quite a bit of publicity and were held forward as the best examples, only to find as further data were acquired, and to the credit of the Cassini team, you know, they did good due diligence and acquire additional data to test their ideas. And let's review some of those results. Okay, on slide 13, this is just a slide showing how popular the idea and the notion of cryovolcanism was. It's just a very long list of some of the papers that were published in peer-reviewed literature which discussed cryovolcanism on Titan. Let's go to slide 14. Okay, this is the first feature that was discussed. This was seen in the very first radar flyby of Titan. The feature was later named Ganesha Macula, and it did resemble, I mean, when I saw the picture the first time, I agreed that certainly it did resemble a radar image of what was a so-called pancake dome volcano that was seen on Venus by Magellan radar, albeit this one's about 10 times the size of those pancake domes. So it was a very intriguing feature, and people, you know, developed a lot of enthusiasm for this, because, of course, if we right away could see features which look like large volcanic constructs on Titan, it would go a long, long way to explain how methane is being replenished in its atmosphere. So it seemed reasonable to expect that we'd see features that would be doing this methane replenishing, and this appeared to be one. Let's go to slide 15. Subsequently, additional flybys were made, which allowed Lisa Randi's technique of stereo imaging and deriving the topography from the sort of stereo imaging. And it turns out that the Ganesha Macula is a suite of features, including a ridge which runs along the east side. The center of the feature, in fact, appears to be a dry lake, and then the features which are radially approaching the lake seem to be probably drainage features that are transporting or have transported fluid into that lake. And otherwise, the feature breaks down and doesn't resemble in hardly any way what one would expect as landforms diagnostic of a volcano. Let's go to slide 16. The next feature, this was proposed by the VIMS team. It was a tremendous amount of enthusiasm. They wrote a very enthusiastic paper in Nature, it was published in 2005, in which, as you can see, they developed a geologic map, as you can see in Figure 4, and so on, and came up with a very nice story about this feature, suggesting that based upon the relative brightness of the center of it, that it was sticking up higher in the atmosphere through the haze, and they did an argument for that showing topography, and it had a dark dot towards the center, which they interpreted to be possibly a caldera, and so on. Let's go to slide 17. But when the radar system acquired imaging of this area, it turned out to be pretty much a nondescript spot of highlands material that you see often in this part of Titan that simply has unambiguous sand dunes sweeping past it. Now, of course, you can't argue this feature might not have at one time been a volcano or something, but you really can't tell what it is, except that it's basically a topographic obstruction sticking out of a dune field, and I would be reticent to propose it's any particular thing other than a piece of local highlands topography, perhaps eroded by aeolian blasting. Let's go to slide 18. Now, there were several different studies that were discussed in 2009, published in 2009, discussing Hotai Arcus. One suggested that photometric variations were due to ongoing volcanic eruptions, and this is something that was done by Nelson and his colleagues. And in a companion paper, essentially, there was a discussion that the bright lobes in this region, you can see these bright features that kind of look like a mushroom. There's one that's part of the thing that's centered here, were identified as flows by a paper by Steve Wall and his colleagues. Let's go to slide 19. Now, once again, Randy developed, used his technique of deriving topography, and it turned out that the bright features, which were thought to be the bright lobes in the original paper, actually turned out to be level and lowest lying terrain in the scene. Now, I know that subsequently there's been a suggestion that, oh, well, it was the dark lobes that are next to the bright lobes that are, since they're the higher, they could be volcanic features. And, you know, once again, one cannot, you know, demonstrate that that's false. But, again, I would argue that extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof and it's, again, not compelling that anything about these now darker, higher features are necessarily volcanic. I can't prove they're not, but there's nothing that makes you say, oh, yes, that's a volcanic feature. And indeed, the scene could be completely explained by exogenic processes alone, which is the point that Bob and I have made in our Icarus paper, that everything you see, that is a possible explanation. In as much as we see the landscape of Titan does have unambiguously features that are formed by exogenic processes, Occam's razor would point towards applying that explanation to all the landforms, unless there's something about something of them which makes it simply impossible to use that explanation to explain what you're looking at. Let's go to slide 20. Oh, this is just a review of the material that had been proposed about changes, photometric changes. This was examined by other members of the Cassini team in a paper by Larry Soderbaum and his colleagues, and they suggested alternatively that the apparent changes were simply due to lower resolution data, that if you looked at the higher resolution data as a function of the phase angle, that there was nothing remarkable about the brightness, presumed brightness changes that were seen reported in the first paper. And slide 21, and this is just a point I just made before, that, you know, the alternate explanation, certainly for the bright lobes, such as they are, is that they simply are dried-up basins that have material which has been transported out on the surface, and some process brightens those surfaces. I don't know what that process that brightens the surfaces may be. There's a number of things which might work. I initially really liked the idea of it being evaporites, but I've had a conversation with several conversations back with Chris McKay recently. He's been working very, very hard to try to find something that can both dissolve and then later precipitate in ethane-methane mixtures, and he can't get anything to do it. So there may be evaporites which work, but no one can identify them, which is frustrating because I personally like the evaporite idea. But some process, it could just simply be larger grained material being transported out there that has higher radar scatter at the wavelengths of the radar system. Or it could be some process which has to do with how the lakes basically dry up, you know, the equivalent of forming mud cracks or something like that, which basically brightens up the floors of these dried lakes and produces these bright scenes. Let's go to slide 22. I think that segues into a paper which Alan Howard and I published in JGR last November, where we offer alternate explanations for these features which had been proposed in the last several years as possible volcanic flow fields. We proposed that it was interesting that the bright shapes you see in Hotai Regio and Tui Regio strongly resemble the bright floor depressions found in both polar regions of Titan. And as you all know, these bright features have been identified by scientists as dry lakes. There's been several good papers written on that subject by Alex Hayes and Odette Aronson and a number of other people who are on your team who've examined these features. These scarp enclosed bright floor depressions are almost identical in shape to the lakes and these dry lakes. And it's interesting when you look at the ones in the polar regions, they become progressively more fluid filled as you move towards the poles and drier as you move away from the poles. So let's go to slide 23. So here we propose that this is in fact what's going on at Hotai Regio and Tui Regio, that in both cases, these bright, for lack of a better term, lobate features, which we identify as dry lakes, are located in the centers of regional depressions based upon the available topographic data. Both regions have converging fluvial networks coming down from their surrounding highlands, and the arrows in these pictures, notionally point generally to the direction these things are going. And that they possess central basin floors which are covered with these features which strongly resemble the dry lakes we see in the polar regions. Let's go to slide 24. So that is basically the argument we make for why the features can alternatively be interpreted as dry lakes. I know in the meantime, I saw a very good poster by Jason Barnes and his colleagues where they've also noticed that the 5-micron bright features that are associated with dry lake floors in the polar regions correspond very nicely with the 5-micron bright features which go with Tui and Hotai Regio. And I think there's probably a growing agreement amongst us that these signatures collectively suggest that we are looking at dry lakes and not volcanic flows. Now, I know that we do see things on Titan, and I know there was a news report on a feature called Sutra Facula back in December, which suggested that it might be a volcano, and, heck, of course, it might be a volcano. But, again, the problem with a landscape like Titan, which is so sculpted by precipitation and runoff, is there are a lot of processes there's a lot of landforms which can be formed by fluvial erosion, such as simply erosion on a piece of rolling cratered uplands, which will produce a feature which will have a passing resemblance to a volcano. And here the two figures on the left and in the center are before and after figures from Alan Howard's landform evolution modeling. And then the figure on the right is an actual spot on the Martian landscape in the Martian cratered highlands where precipitation and runoff has indeed produced an isolated massif which has a passing resemblance to a volcano. It's interesting, though, to think that, we don't see any examples of volcanic mountains anyplace else on any other icy satellite in the solar system. So if Titan were to have such features, it would certainly be unique in the solar system for possessing them. Let's go to slide 25. Now, I've said that there aren't any endogenic features on Titan, and that's an overstatement. I think certainly there is some form of tectonism on Titan. I think when you look at the structural features you see in Xanadu and so on, clearly there is some crustal breaking and movement going on at the surface. But I do also remind everyone that can be due to relatively passive forces, such as just changes in the phases of material in the interior as the satellite cools off, or due to orbital recession, or due to any other processes which might operate cause distortions on the planetary surface. I mean, to give an example, we don't typically think of Rhea as being a hotbed of endogenic activity, but yet it has a very nice, nearly north to pole to south pole modern Graben system, which runs down the 270-degree longitude line. And you can see it's modern because, it, in fact, it cuts most of the pre-existing craters. So even Rhea has some, you know, relatively passive tectonism going on it. And so it'd be difficult to imagine that Titan would not have at least as much tectonic activity as Rhea does. Let's go on to slide 26. And this just going, you know, just reiterates the points I just made that these tectonic features could be due to, you know, contraction. They could be externally driven from tidal interactions or atmospheric, you know, decreasing eccentricity or non-synchronous rotation, polar flattening, or just even large impacts. I mean, large, you know, Callisto has very nice, very beautiful rolling a topography that's interrupted by large fracture systems, which are just part of its multi-ring basins. And I'll actually show you an example what that looks like when you rain on it here shortly. Slide 27, this illustrates that another curious thing about Titan and the suggestion that Titan's interior may be cooler than, for instance, that of Ganymede or Callisto's, that when you look at the largest impact features on Titan, and particularly Minerva, the one you see at the bottom center of this picture, it doesn't really resemble similar sized impacts on Ganymede or even Callisto, as you can see in the case of Lofen there in the lower right-hand corner. What it most closely resembles are these sort of peak ring basins that you see amongst that make up the largest impact basins you see on the other Saturnian satellites. In this case, I show Evander on Dione there in the left-hand side for comparison. Let's go to slide 28. So that comes to the provocative statement, you know, Titan, is it Callisto of weather? You know, is Xanadu, for instance, an eroded crater? Cratered Craton, as has in fact been suggested by members of the Cassini team. Let's go to slide 29. Well, let's ask the question, can fluvial erosion patterns tell us anything about initial landscape types? And so questions we've asked ourselves is, you know, to what degree can formative processes, morphologies of initial endogenic or cratered landscapes be inferred after sufficient modification by fluvial erosion to resemble Titan's surface? You know, how much erosion would have to occur to make these inferences about the nature of the landscape impossible? And so the goals of this study that Alan Howard and I, along with using DEM models from Paul Shank, have tried to do is to determine the existence and recognizability of endogenic processes on Titan, if they're there. You know, determine the relative dominance in nature of fluvial activity on the landscape, you know, to understand expression and rates of erosion on the landscape, the redistribution of sediment there, and see if we could also recognize specific morphological expressions of modified endogenic landforms if they're there. Let's go to slide 30. So our preliminary results of the model, we used Alan Howard's landform evolution model to simulate fluvial and lacustrine modification of other icy satellite landscapes to see what would happen and see to what extent they might replicate the present landscape of Titan. We did this on several landscapes. We've done it on a mixture of endogenic belts and zones of blocks of older crane, but with little regional relief. We used Ganymede for that purpose. We also looked at a thoroughly tectonized surface of little regional relief, and that we used Europa. And then we used a regionally cratered or mantled landscape and mantle landscape with some regional relief due to impact basin ring tectonics. And for that purposes, we used Callisto. The nice thing about those three Galilean satellites is they have almost exactly the same surface gravity as Titan, and Ganymede and Callisto are almost exactly the same size of Titan. They're all and the same density as Titan. Okay, let's briefly talk about things you see on Titan itself. This is a view of the uplands region of Titan, which has this pronounced banding or crinkling, which we interpret to be ridge and valley patterns of fluvially dissected topography. And the red arrows here point to trunk fluvial valleys, and the smooth dark areas are interpreted to be sedimentary basins. Let's go to slide 32. And this image shows dissected uplands in the high southern latitudes of Titan. Blue arrows point to sinuous channels that are flowing in smooth dark areas at the crosshatch mark. And we interpret this to be a sedimentary basin, possibly of shallowly covered methane lake. And the red arrows point to trunk drainage systems in the detected highlands. So, by the way, the blue arrows point to actually appears to be a channel crossing a sediment plain. You rarely see channels in images like this. Usually you see the valleys that are occupied by channels. Slide 33. This just goes through some of our initial modeling assumptions. I'll try not to, you know, let me see if I can blast through them pretty quickly. We assume complete runoff, so the depressions become lakes, and the drainage exits somewhere along the edges of the simulation domain. Edges of the simulation domain are fixed, they're not erodible. Flow rates are scaled to tighten gravity. The rate of channel incision is proportional to the shear stress on the bed. Weathering products are transportable, become transportable debris, and they can collect where they would fall out of transportation. Sediment is deposited in low-lying areas, producing alluvial fans and infilling depressions. There is very little fine sediment being deposited in these lakes in this particular model. That doesn't mean that in reality fine sediment doesn't, in fact, collect in the lakes. And the spatial patterns shouldn't, and the bottom line is that the spatial patterns shouldn't vary much with these different parameters, but the rate of erosion will be very affected. So what I'm saying is I can't tell you how fast it takes these landscapes go from their uneroded landscapes to their eroded landscapes. That will require a lot of additional work, including a lot of work that will have to be done in labs. But the pattern that would be formed by fluvial erosion would sooner or later manifest itself in a manner which looks, we think, much like they as will be seen in these models. Okay, we looked at Ganymede first, and what's interesting out of Ganymede is that there are no long, deeply incised valleys, but there are extensive alluvial plains. Some depressions remain unfilled, hosting lakes. And the remaining depressions, the lakes, have well-defined shorelines encroaching, which are made of encroaching delta fronts, which, interesting, kind of resemble some of the depressions, lakes and dry lakes, you see elsewhere on Titan. In fact, one of the things that people, including myself, have tried to understand is why do the dry lakes and lakes on Titan have these very well-defined steep shorelines, and why didn't they drive? Do they basically leave behind pits? And as Alan Howard and I talk about in our GRL paper of last November, these shorelines appear accretional. The evolution of the lakes in this particular model of Alan's, in fact, you know, suggested that that sequence of events or that type of processing is, in fact, what's contributing to for these accretionary shorefronts. Let's see, and also I want to point out that extensive erosion of the landscape does not really erase the signature of the original tectonic overprint of the topography. Let's go to slide 35. It's a similar situation here on Europa that you see on Ganymede after fluvial action. Again, no really well-developed integrated fluvial systems. The persistence of the signature of the original topographic overprint remains pretty obvious. Let's go to slide 36. Okay, so we did Callisto. We did the Asgard impact multi-ring basin Robin system, and the main image on top is just the DEM used to colorize the original photo base map, and then the bottom image is just a shaded relief version of the DEM itself. Let's go to slide 37. Okay, this shows what this surface looks like after having fluvial work. And so you can see the initial landscape again on top, the fluvial work surface on the bottom. Let's go to slide 38 and talk about what this means. Okay, so Callisto's cratered surface, which is mantled, but so is Titan's by atmospheric-derived solids, and only weakly tectonized, in this case by basin ring tectonics, when rained upon, produces a surface where the highlands are fluvially dissected and the lowlands are broadly filled with sediment. This resembles much of the highlands of Titan, much more so than Ganymede or Europa does with rain. And the only difference between the picture on the left is that it's simply a blow-up of the figure on the bottom. I should have put a box on it to show you where that figure is from. What I did do is I turned back on the parameter geology to actually light up the trunk valleys so you can see the major fluvial features that would exist on this landscape. Let's go to slide 39. So the preliminary conclusions from the landform evolution modeling is that combinations of convoluted short wavelength topography is exhibited by these intensely tectonized surfaces on Ganymede and Callisto, and the little overall regional topography on the order of a kilometer results in little erasure of tectonic texture and poorly expressed, although well integrated on small scales, fluvial networks when it's rained upon. And the same modeling suggests that initial landscapes like that of Callisto, which have larger regional relief, an order of 2 or 3 kilometers, and are weakly tectonized, is susceptible to large-scale fluvial dissection and produces nice long valley networks that are well-formed and well-integrated. And there's the attendant alluvial infilling of low-lying regions, which does produce a landscape that at least reasonably resembles parts of Xanadu, for instance. Some of the issues we still have to address with this is that there is the importance of fluvially transportable sediment. We're still trying to make sure we understand exactly how much of that would be done and how much of it's available to be done. What might be the consequences of compensative uplift of the highlands undergoing fluvial denudation? That would be a situation where as highlands are eroded, they may rise due to isostatic uplift, and the nearby basins where the sediment is being dumped might undergo further subsidence. And then there's the issue of how much erosion can upland landscapes endure before the original texture, craters, or otherwise become basically unrecognizable. We're still trying to understand that. Let's go to slide 40. So here's kind of the points about the idea of Titan as an internally quiescent world. Titan may have accreted relatively cold, as you probably heard of the people report. Titan may never have experienced significant tidal heating. You know, there's been several studies recently published that suggest that Titan may be incompletely differentiated. Which you all know what this means. I'm sorry that slide kind of has been dumbed down because I've given this to a couple of astronomical societies. And there's also no internal magnetic field, as you would expect in the case, or as you would expect, and it has not been detected in Titan. Let's go to slide 41. So consistency with geophysical arguments. A cool, quiescent interior is consistent with incomplete differentiation, as been published by Ice and his colleagues. A cool interior is consistent with Titan's flattened shape, which suggests a currently conductive, not convective, ice shell above a cool ammonia water ocean. That's something Francis Nemo and Bruce Bills have written about recently. An internal ammonia water ocean is permitted even if the deep interior is incompletely differentiated, and Titan's orbital eccentricity should have damped out this interior, should have been damped if the interior was warm, and so this high eccentricity can be ancient if the interior is cool and relatively non-dissipative. Let's go to slide 42. So the question again, Titan, Callisto of weather. What is different? Different from Callisto, Titan does have a thick atmosphere. Impacts can, in fact, generate a significant atmosphere at Titan, as has been proposed by Kevin Zonley a couple of occasions. Titan's atmosphere may have been inflated and then deflated through time. This is something I want to come back to at the end of this talk. And this has been proposed by papers that Chris McKay and Jonathan Lunin and Ralph Lorenz and others have worked on over the last 20 years. And then there's the whole business of Titan's of Argon-40. The Argon-40 you see in the atmosphere could, in fact, be a remnant of the late heavy bombardment. And that's something that Bill McKinnon talked about in an LPSC talk year before last. Okay, slide 43. So here's some conclusions. The only unambiguously identified landforms in Titan are exogenic, fluvial, aeolian, and impact. There are no unambiguously identified endogenic landforms in Titan, i.e. cryovolcanism. A viable working hypothesis is that Titan is basically a Callisto of weather with a cool interior and only exogenic geological processes operating on its surface. This idea has been tested through additional Cassini observations, as I reviewed in this talk, and geophysical and thermal modeling have suggested this to be the case, and modeling of the evolution of the landscape by exogenic processes alone also tend to confirm that you can generate surfaces which resemble that of which we see on Titan. Let's go to slide 44. Okay, what's the implication of the climate history if you have ancient crated terrain on Titan? If Titan displays regions of degraded ancient crated terrain, then this would have a significant impact for Titan's history. I mean, Martian fluvially degraded landscapes still exist only because the fluvial activity largely ceased soon after the curtailment of heavy bombardment. So for Titan to still have such terrains and ongoing fluvial activity, at least in some places on the satellite, would imply at least three possible explanations. The first one is that methane fluvial erosion on Titan is extremely inefficient relative to that of water on the Earth or Mars, or that fluvial erosion very rarely occurs on some regions of Titan. Basically, there is, you know, places that are extremely desertified or, you know, ultra arid, or else it's only recently started raining on Titan in recent geologic times. Let's go to slide 45. So this goes back to this idea of a, what you might call a Triton-Titan-Mars alternate explanation for the history of Titan that has emerged from these papers I alluded to by Chris and Ralph and Jonathan and so on, published particularly in the 1990s. And so in this idea, the volatiles on Titan simply lay frozen on the surface, unavailable to do geologic work until geologic recent time. And what eventually caused the atmosphere to suddenly form would have been attributed to several factors. One possibility is that during the period in which the volatiles were setting on the surface of Titan, the surface was extremely bright. And here I have Triton sitting in as a surrogate for this idea, reflecting most of the sunlight back into space, and it was only as the sun, which, as we all know, has been slowly but surely getting brighter and brighter over the history of the solar system, that it finally reach a point where the albedo system, the albedo effect, was overwhelmed, and the volatiles on the surface very rapidly decomposed into gases and very rapidly formed an atmosphere. And so in this scenario, you can imagine that Titan may have formed its atmosphere from a geological perspective basically all at once, and all the methane that has ever been on Titan to do geologic work was all at once initially available in the atmosphere. And so some number in, 10 times, pick a number, I don't know what the number is, 10 times as much methane may have been in the atmosphere, say, in this early methane or this early atmosphere moment to do geologic work on the surface of Titan than there is today. But of course, as we know, methane is photolysized into solids and is, in fact, what, amongst other things, forms the dunes. We see the dune fields which make up the equatorial regions of Titan. And so as the methane was drawn out of the atmosphere and became unavailable to do geologic work, the atmosphere has been drying out, and maybe we live in a world that's kind of like Percival Lowell's view of Mars, that slowly but surely that the hydrologic system is retreating to the poles, and that may explain or be one of the explanations for why we only see lakes these days and seas these days only in the polar regions of Titan. And this process is, in fact, what's really happening, and there's no new outgassing of CO2, of CH4, then atmospheric methane will be exhausted sometime very soon, certainly in less than a billion years. In fact, some calculations say as soon as 30 million years from now, leaving Titan with a surface simply covered with the dark detritus of its former methane and otherwise a bright blue methane sky. So I'll go to the last slide, slide 46. And suggest that maybe Chesley Bonestell's paintings that we all probably remember from being kids, if you're at least my age, of a beautiful Saturn hanging in a blue sky above Titan may have portrayed a realistic Titan after all, but one which will exist in the future. And I will leave my talk points with this slide and take questions. Thank you very much.
Wow. Are there any questions? Because one of the things that I was wondering about when I first looked through the presentation, and I didn't see anything about timescales, and Dr. Moore, you alluded to that in saying how difficult it is to actually work out these rates of erosion and that work is going to be required to do this in the labs. And I'm wondering what is going to be done, because it really seems key to figure out how this compares to the endogenic timescales and whatever tectonic timescales might be in place.
Well, there has been some lab work done. Jeff Collins and his colleagues have been funded for the last several years to do some of this work in the lab, and they find it's very, very hard to erode Titan's landscape, that it basically could be relatively resistant to erosion unless it already has a lot of loose material on the surface to start with. So again, if this alternate explanation for Titan's history, that Titan was basically sitting out there subjected to cratering, and it was basically a large cratered landscape until the atmosphere flashed into being in geologic recent times, then an explanation for the availability of sediment to be transported is simply the former impact regolith of Titan from the late heavy bombardment. But that work is preliminary. I don't think Jeff's had a chance to write it up yet. And I guess at this point, Alan and I are reticent to say too much more about that at this time until we give Jeff a chance to publish his results. Although, as I say, it is interesting that you kind of need to have some sediment to start with to get the ball rolling.
This is Anne Schmidekamp, a NASA Solar System Ambassador from Pennsylvania.
Uh-huh.
I have a question about slide 41. Your last point on
41.
That slide was that Titan's orbital eccentricity should have damped if its interior is warm. Could you explain that? I'm not sure I understand the reason.
Yes, that if it has a warm interior, it's more susceptible to tidal flexing as a consequence of its eccentric orbit, and this this tidal flexing process will result in the exchange of energy between Titan and Saturn as such as to drive Saturn to extract orbital energy from Titan and cause Titan to go into a more circular orbit. So a slightly warmer interior that's slightly more susceptible to actual body tides will evolve in a matter of some tens of millions of years. And I don't do planetary orbital dynamics. I'm only telling you what I hear people report in the literature. Would cause the orbit to become circularized. So the only way you could actually have, or one of the ways you could have the present orbital eccentricity of Titan would be if Titan's interior is very rigid and relatively unsusceptible to actual forming a response to body tides.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Other questions? One more from me here at JPL. I'm wondering, what data are you really looking forward to most in the coming 6 years from Titan flybys for the rest of the mission?
Well, I really hope we will acquire as much additional coverage with the imaging system as we can, and especially since using Brian Stiles' great technique of getting, SAR topo along the individual sub swabs of the swab, as well as where we have crossovers, so that Randy can produce more DEMs is I think going to be really important to try to kind of fill in the picture. I think that the ability to kind of piece together with what will eventually have the end of mission of what the distribution of landforms are on Titan, and what they are and where they are and how common they are and the sequence in which they were formed will go a long, long way to understanding exactly, what is the history of volatiles on Titan. Will we eventually find features which that there is large consensus that they, in fact, are evidence for outgassing, and so Titan's atmosphere is being replenished? Or are we going to see evidence that suggests that, in fact, this episode of fluvial activity on Titan is relatively recent in Titan's history? industry, and it's also undergoing a non-reversible process where there was a lot of it once it started, but it's rapidly declining to a situation where it's going to go away, which would then support this, you know, this Triton-Mars hypothesis that I borrowed the name from Chris McCabe as the alternate explanation for what's happening on the satellite.
Hi, this is Lee Green, Solar System Ambassador. Do we see these erosion activities, I guess they're called fluvial activities, do we see those throughout the planets?
You see them on planets that have had rain, so you see them really only on three worlds, on the one we live on Mars and on Titan.
So you take that as definitive proof that rain actually is occurring there?
I think it is definitive proof that rain has occurred there and probably still is occurring. There's plenty of evidence that precipitation reaches the ground on Titan. The question is it simply forming as ground fogs which directly precipitate and fill up the lakes? I know, for instance, there was a recent report by Zibby Turtle and her colleagues that showed that after the equinox storms took place in the equatorial regions of Titan, that there had been changes in the brightness of the surface, which suggests at the very least that some rainfall reached the ground and may have washed some of the surface and brightened the surface a bit. Now, whether it was enough rainfall to actually do a lot of geologic work and fill up streams and transport material downstream and so on, I don't know. That would be hard to say. My intuition suggests that these current equatorial equinox events may be insufficient to do a lot of geologic work and may only simply brighten the surface a bit, but that's something that has to be further investigated.
This is John Cooper from Goddard.
Yes, sir.
Yes. So you are not finding any evidence for internally driven cryovolcanism. However, you're talking about fluvial features and potentially a ammonia water ocean below a conductive ice shell.
Yes.
Is it conceivable that still there is connection between the fluvial flows on the surface through channels to that ocean other than, you know, cryovolcanism?
I have to say I'd be very skeptical if there was. I mean, the truth is that every object the size of Titan that we've seen in the solar system all have small oceans, you know, wedged between the lower density and the higher density phases of ice in their interior. I mean, for instance, you know, Callisto has a little liquid water layer that's, I think people estimate to be around 15 kilometers thick, and it lies about 150 kilometers beneath the surface. And so In the sorts of modeling I've heard people report out on the interior of Titan, I think people anticipate that there is an ocean that is something of a similar thickness and existing probably at similar depths beneath Titan. And we really have to kind of think of these as like liquid layers in planetary interiors, deep in planetary interiors that are of geophysical interest, but they may not have any communication with the surface of the satellite. And again, Callisto is a perfectly good example of that. I think the looking at the patterns of erosion, fluvial erosion on the surface of Titan, those patterns are entirely consistent with precipitation and runoff from rainfall. And there's nothing about them which suggests that they are due to fluids coming up from the interior. Now, having said that, that doesn't mean there isn't probably, you know, the equivalent of groundwater on Titan, but that's still, you know, near-surface reservoirs of fluids which are placed in the near subsurface of Titan the same way that groundwater is found in the interior of the upper crust of the Earth. It's simply rainfall, which is percolated into the ground, is stored there, and under certain circumstances becomes available to the surface again as a source of fluid and even sometimes some geologic work.
If you'll indulge me, I did have one kind of sociological question. I was wondering if there was any link or if it was simply coincidence that you started off learning about history and you've moved on to learning about the history of moons.
There is, of course, some link. It's probably not a surprise that I'm a geologist and not a geochemist, for instance. And the Titan community has been largely dominated by geochemists, and that's because the nature of the information we acquired about Titan lended itself to geochemical analysis and investigation. But geochemists, maybe this is perhaps where the philosophical difference lies between the way the whole community has approached, or the Titan community has approached the study of the satellite. They can be interested in the world as it is because they're interested in the chemistry that is there now. And so you can do a whole series of studies which in some epistemological sense can be all done in the timeless present, because you talk about what's happening on Titan today and it isn't necessarily important what Titan was like a billion years ago, but since my predisposition is historical, I look at both the affairs of humans as well as the affairs of planets and ask myself, how did they get to where they are today? So I want to know, what was some place like a billion years ago or 2 billion years ago or 3 billion years ago, and is the world that you see today the world that existed then? And if not, how did it get from this earlier existence to its present existence?
Thank you.
Sure.
Are there any other questions? Well, in that case, I'd like to thank our speaker again very much for a fascinating talk, and I hope that everything that we want to have come back from the mission actually executes and actually downlinks.
I hope
thank
so,
again
too.
Very much.
Thank you for inviting me to give the talk.
Thanks to everybody very much.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.